From the Sky News Centre at 5. A breast surgeon who carried out completely unnecessary operations has been convicted of 20 counts of wounding. Ian Paterson exaggerated or invented cancer risks. Nick Qureshi reports.
Paterson committed the crimes in the West Midlands between 1997 and 2011. Francis Perks was a victim.
It's very hard to accept. To say that I hate him is an understatement.
Just 10 patients were involved in the trial, but there could be thousands of victims. Debbie Douglas was also affected.
I've been left physically damaged, I feel like I've been mutilated. All this was for nothing.
Police say the motives aren't clear.
Has he done this for financial gain, or has he done this just because he feels like playing God?
Paterson will be sentenced next month when he could get a life sentence.
A terror suspect arrested near Parliament yesterday has been named as Khalid Mohammed Omer Ali. The 27-year-old is a British national who was born overseas and went to school in Tottenham, North London. In a separate operation, an active terror plot was foiled after police launched an armed raid in northwest London, which a woman was shot and injured. She's currently under armed guard. 6 people have been arrested. The US Secretary of State says threats of nuclear attack by North Korea on Japan and South Korea are real. Rex Tillerson has told the United Nations it must act.
Getting Bristol home on BCFM 93.2.
10 years of Bristol's finest.
BCFM.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Metro Mayor Hustings Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and joining me for a full 2 hours until seven are most of the Metro Mayor candidates. That is to say, for the Green Party, Darren Hall, Labour's Leslie Mansell, Liberal Democrat Stephen Williams, and UKIP's Aaron Foote. I'll be putting a variety of questions to them all about current affairs, their role as Metro Mayor, and asking them to share their wider values for a just society, and about how to spend our money, which is mostly what these mayors are about, with the main responsibility for housing, planning, adult education and transport. The Tory candidate Tim Bowles is accompanying a government minister at a secret location here in Bristol today and wasn't sure when he'd be here, be free, or even if he could make it at all. So we have an empty chair here for him today. Also, Theresa May is possibly going to be empty chaired in the general election too. Worth noting, the Conservative Party declined to participate 2 years ago in our 2015 general election hustings on this show as well. Also, at 2:30 today, I got a number withheld call from someone saying they spoke for independent candidate John Savage. He wouldn't disclose his name or his role, but he did say John Savage would be at a hospital trust meeting until 6:30 today, so wouldn't be able to come. I asked who I was speaking to, and he told me his name was irrelevant. When asked whether John would have time to do the Metro Mayor job properly whilst working for the hospital trust, he told me I was a conspiracy theorist, then put the phone down. I subsequently confirmed John Savage wouldn't be available today with Zara, his publicist. One of the questions I wanted to ask John Savage was how open he would be as Metro Mayor, because all of the requests I've put in to interview him as chairman of United Bristol Hospitals NHS Trust, spending around £500 million of our money every year, have been refused. And as a former master of the Merchant Venturers, it would have been interesting to get his views on Edward Colston and this week's announcement of the Colston Hall name change. We'll meet the candidates in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius and mainly dry. This weekend, highs of 14 Celsius, cloudy with some sunny spells. Tomorrow, breezy with rain arriving on Sunday, I'm afraid. Highs of 16 Celsius next week, sunny spells with occasional showers. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of May, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast for the bank holiday weekend, the May Day bank holiday weekend, even though we're supposed to call it, the government call it the early May bank holiday, but everyone else calls it the May Day bank holiday. And that was from theweatheroutlook.com. So first, let's get to know the candidates and ask each of them to explain what the Metro Mayor is all about. Just to complicate things, Bristol's third mayor, this is, after the Lord Mayor and the City Council mayors. It's known officially as the Combined Authorities Mayor. And if you were wanting to find out who the Combined Authorities are, that's tough. Their website is down for maintenance. They say, luckily though, that we have some people here who we can ask. At 2:30, as I said, John Savage announced he couldn't make it here, and also we haven't got Tim Bowles, the Conservative candidate, who's looking after a government minister, we're told. So let's have a round, first of all, a sort of introductory round with some first questions, starting with UKIP's Aaron Foote. Now, UKIP, whose idea is this Metro Mayor? What's their annual budget? And what will you do if you're elected?
Obviously, the annual budget's going to be £30 million. And it was an idea from the local government and national government to devolution powers from centralised government back to the people. We already have this Metro Mayor system in place. It is combined so far with the three local authorities, well, four actually, including North Somerset, which have decided not to get involved in this Metro Mayor.
So why is it you think that North Somerset have decided not to? Actually, you're from that part of the world, aren't you?
Well, I'm from over by Yate, Bristol, work, and then obviously I work, and I'm not sure of this, I work over the border in Somerset, literally in spitting distance from Leslie, and yeah, it's a lovely part of the world.
So why is it, do you think, North Somerset have decided they're not interested in this being part of this Metro Mayor, and taking some of the money, I would imagine? They're probably losing money out of it.
Technically, they've said they're not going to be part of the devolution deal, so therefore they're technically not part of this £1 billion project over the next couple of years, and they're also not part of this £30 million devolution deal. But I think they listen to their voters, in North Somerset, possibly, and the Conservative-led coalition, well, the Conservative council, they listened and voted against it.
So, for the Lib Dems, Stephen Williams, whose idea is the Metro Mayor? What's the budget, and what will you do if you're elected?
Well, the genesis of this was back in 2014, during the days of the coalition government, when actually Michael Heseltine wrote a report for the coalition called No Stone Unturned, where he recommended that instead of England's great city regions bidding to central government every year, quite a demeaning process really, to ask for sort of crumbs off the table from central government, instead there would be an annual grant from central government to the city regions so that they could spend that amount as they pleased. But in order to have oversight of that, there would need to be some political accountability. And it was also partly to address the sort of democratic deficit in between Wales, Scotland and the city regions of England, because we were considering this at the time of the Scottish referendum. So as Aaron just said, the extra money, and this is what people keep getting wrong, the extra money is £30 million a year. I'm going to go wrong myself. £30 million a year, so £120 million over the four-year term. But the big potatoes aren't that. They're the devolved transport budget, which could be hundreds of millions, and devolve control over some part of the skills budget, which is about £166 million a year as well. So actually, big powers: housing, jobs, transport, skills, and a big budget too.
How about you, Labour's Leslie Mansell? What's your take on this Metro Mayor, what the annual budget is, and what the purpose is?
Well, hi, Tony, and hi to all your listeners. My name's Leslie Mansell. I'm the Labour and Cooperative Party candidate for Metro Mayor. The idea came from George Osborne, so it was his baby. And what we're going to get is more money and more powers. And I think it would be really good to talk a little bit more in depth about what those are. If you want to find out more about the Metro Mayor's role, then do check out on my website, Mansell for Metro Mayor, and you'll find a very simple question and answer sheet there. But the role itself is to do with, initially, housing, transport, skills for people over 19, and also the economy. And we know what we've got here in this part of the world, the west of England. We have got the wealthiest part of the country outside of London, and yet we've got a massive, massive situation where we've got a big gap regarding skills, regarding how people get on in life. We've got a situation where women earn less than men, worse than anywhere else in the country. Black people earn less than white people. So that's what some of this should hopefully address.
And what about you, Darren Hall, for the Green Party? What's your idea of where this came from? It didn't really seem to sort of bubble up from the bottom, from the citizenry. It's come down. We've heard George Osborne's name mentioned. We've heard Michael Heseltine's name mentioned. This is their kind of brainchild, it seems. But what do you think you'll do with this budget if you're elected?
Well, I'm actually going to look even further afield, in that other cities in Europe, particularly in Germany, have been able to help the German economy much more so than cities in the UK. And economists here were looking across the water and saying that, looking at other countries in Europe, then their economy was better balanced across the country. Whereas what we know in the UK, that basically it's London plus a little bit. And we in the west of England are the only bit of the UK economy outside of London which is a net contributor to the Treasury. Now, hopefully we can continue to do that and do better. But other areas in the UK, the Northern Powerhouse that people are talking about, that's the sort of the devolution agenda was all about saying, back to government, well, if you want us to do better, you need to give us more freedom in what we can do. So the big bit for me about this devolution agenda is the ability to raise money locally and spend it locally.
Okay, I would also say that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, thanks, Leslie, for mentioning your website, but I'll put up links to all the candidates' websites on there. So if you want to check out what whether what they're saying now agrees with what they're saying on the internet, you can do that. And also you'll find out a lot more about what is the purpose of the Metro Mayor ultimately. A little bit of a quick round now. I want to ask you all, starting with you, Stephen Williams, why was there no referendum about this? When we had a mayor for Bristol, it was quite a big hoo-ha. Everyone was asked, do you want a mayor? This time we've just been told you're having a mayor.
Well, that was a decision made by... the genesis of this, as I said, was under the coalition government. Of course, the actual legislation to create the six that are going ahead was done under the current Conservative government. And while they were an enthusiast for a referendum on the European Union, which I think was a dreadful mistake, looking at my UKIP colleague right opposite me in the studio, they obviously decided not to have referendums on devolution. Because let's face it, one of the things we know is that the public never votes for extra politicians. I think we've all encountered on the streets, there is huge scepticism about whether we need extra MPs and so on.
We voted for the mayor, didn't we? The Bristol mayor.
Yes, and in Bristol was the only city that did, and I think that was probably a lesson for the government, that generally if you say, do you want more politicians to run things, they're quite likely say no. I'm trying to give an honest explanation, trying to second guess what the Conservatives decided, and this was an important opportunity to get devolution right, baby steps, but to start making those steps inside England, and we didn't want to falter again. Let's face it, the reason we're in this mess is because 17 years ago the northeast of England rejected devolution in a referendum. That's why only London has got devolution in England. I would not want us to wait another 17 years to get devolution in Bristol, Birmingham and elsewhere.
I mean, they've had a mayor in Manchester, I think, haven't they, who wasn't actually originally even elected. He was just appointed.
They've done the pilot, yeah.
Leslie, what's your take on why the people of this area, Bristol, Bath, northeast Somerset, south Gloucestershire and north Somerset, weren't actually asked, do you want a Metro Mayor?
Well, there was a consultation. There wasn't a fantastic response to it. There were responses to it. I think it was something like over 1,000 people. So there was a consultation, and then the four local authorities discussed it, and they decided whether they would sign up to it or not. North Somerset decided not to, but Bristol, Bath and North East Somerset and South Gloucestershire decided they would.
Darren,
and that was June last year.
Darren, do you think there should have been a referendum on this, whether we have a Metro Mayor or not?
I'm not sure about a referendum, but I think it was important that there were democratic processes that people could have got involved in. But the reality is that no one saw this coming beyond the political bubble. And I think it would have been another case where people were voting for something they didn't really understand, like the referendum we've just gone through. So...
Yeah, and also maybe very few people would have voted, like the one for the Bristol mayor. It would have been a bit embarrassing in the referendum. It almost says, well, actually people aren't really interested anyway. Aaron Foote for UKIP.
I think we can look at referendums all the time. We can look at Bath last year, where they had a referendum for a mayor and they rejected it. The people don't necessarily want more bureaucracy. What they want is actually democracy. And this is why I'm standing on a platform of e-democracy and letting people have their say. The consultation period was done. It was absolutely dreadful responses, I would say. I think we should have a minimum cut-off on consultations. I think it should be at least like 5% of the population respond in certain areas. We didn't even hit that. And I think personally it should have been consultated a lot more and a lot widely.
Okay, back to you, Darren, for this next one. Less than half the electorate are likely to vote next week because there aren't any normal councillor elections. We're doing them all I think it was last year. They're being done all together now. Why is that? Why are we expecting less than half the electorate to actually vote? And what would you do to address this voter apathy?
You're right, there is voter apathy. I think there's voter fatigue now, not least of all that we've called the snap election. But I think it's on top of the fact that there's a real worry around people turning away from democracy in general. They see it as... They don't trust politicians, they don't trust the processes. And to be frank, actually, if you, even as someone who's keen on democracy, when you turn up to a lot of these political meetings, council meetings, and there's huge stacks of paperwork, and they're long and really quite dull processes, it is very hard to get involved. What is good is that young people are starting to get energised again. Young people are starting to say, hang on a minute, you are... I was going to say a rude word there, with you are messing up our future, and we're not happy about it. So I think that is one way. That another way is, as you know, the Green Party want to bring down the voting age to 16. I think we should be talking to young people about democracy much more fully and sooner in schools to make people understand about it. But having said that, there'll be a growing understanding. This is the first four years of hopefully a long process of greater and greater devolution. And I imagine that by the next time we come to vote on this, there'll be a lot more people that want to have their say.
Yeah, Leslie, it's worrying when people don't actually come and use their vote after all the efforts that have gone over the centuries to actually get the vote for people. What do you put this down to, and what would you do to make convince people that it does make a difference, voting?
I think on the one hand, what we saw with the EU referendum, that people were confused. And if you look at the booklet that came out, the Remain campaign had sourced all of their information, but the Leave campaign had not. So there is an issue there about how much of truth was actually told. People got very confused, they got very fed up, and actually 37% didn't vote at all. But what we're now meeting on the doorstep is people are starting to be enthused, especially now the snap election's been called. But I've been out on the doorstep now since January, along with other Labour Party members, and I'd like to say a big thank you to them, as well as all the union members that have been out, because we are starting to find people are, first of all, understanding a bit more about the Metro Mayor and the devolution and the deal, but also they're starting to engage a bit more, and that's only got to be encouraged. But it's hard work doing that. The media, parts of the media, especially community radio, have been playing a massive part in trying to raise the profile. You can't say that happens right across the media, though, I would say.
Okay, Aaron, your turn. What do you make of this voter apathy? It's pretty awful if, yes, you know, up to half the electorate actually aren't going to be voting in this metro.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. It's awful, and it needs to be sorted. And I think that we can look at the fact that people are getting fed up. They keep going to the polls, and nothing's changed over a couple of years now. Every year we seem to have some form of election around here. And as I'm finding out on the doors, people just want things sorted. And I personally would love us to see actually amalgamate some of these elections. Why can't we suddenly put Parliament on 4 years along with Council and roll everything into one? I know it's going to be absolutely hard for party politicals to fight these battles, but let's actually change the democracy. Let's have an open debate and see where we want to go in the future.
Stephen?
Well, let's not second guess what people are going to do next Thursday. And I think part of the job of all the candidates sat around this table, and the presenter as well, Tony, is to enthuse people about why it's important that they should vote, because these are big issues that the Metro Mayor is going to be responsible for. Responsible for economic prosperity, job creation, land allocation for housing, franchising the bus services, reopening railway stations, controlling the apprenticeship levy, adult skills. These are huge issues that touch every single household right across the west of England. And I think I have been really frustrated, I have to say, to have a pop on another media outlet with the BBC, the Bristol Post and all the rest of them for waiting so long, right up into early April, before they started explaining to people what this role was about. And they've known it was coming for a year. And that's why this is the first time that I've ever stood in an election. I think this is election number 10 for me, where I've had to spend most of the start of a conversation with a voter saying what the job is rather than what I want to do with it. And I don't think any candidate wants to be in that position. If you stand for Parliament, people have an idea what an MP does. Stand for the council, they know what a councillor does. Standing for this position, I've had to say, well, this is being created for this reason, this is the responsibilities and so on. And frankly, the media should have done all that for us. And it's really annoying that we're in this position now, even though we're only 6 days away from the election.
Now, Leslie, we've heard that this is going to have a roughly a £30 million a year budget, £30 million extra, we're told. So that's around about the equivalent of the £30 million Bristol City Council cuts. Can you see why Bristol, why voters think that this may be a con? It's just shifting the money from one part of the public services or one part of government to another?
Absolutely. I can understand people being very frustrated with that, and it almost correlates, doesn't it, the cuts at Bristol Council. But it doesn't just cover Bristol, does it? It's also Bath and North East Somerset and South Gloss. But there's a huge opportunity here for the new Metro Mayor to make a big impact and do things differently. And what I want to do is precisely that. I want to make sure that whatever the money is spent on, it's spent in consultation with people so we can agree priorities together. That what we do is transparent and that there's an impact that is measurable, that we can show that. I think with a lot of government spending, it goes into places, not quite sure where it goes, not quite sure where it does, what it does. So, for example, we know at the moment that £500 million are being spent from the public purse nationally on homelessness. Wouldn't it be better to build council houses and spend £500 million on homelessness?
Darren, what do you make of this? £30 million a year budget, but we're being also told that £30 million has been taken away from Bristol City Council.
Well, for me, it's down to this ideology of the Tory government, which is about everything being economic growth. So what they want, they don't really care about putting money into what they regard as the bottom of society. They want to sort out the top. So they're quite happy to strip money away from the foundations of society, put it into economic development. Business then creates tax, an amount of tax goes in, and then it trickles down to the people who need it. Now, you know, after years of this process, we know that what's happening is the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and it is not narrowing the gap. Now, one of the things that we need to go back to government about, once we get into this process, is say to them is they can't just look at economic growth as the criteria for success of this devolution agenda. They have to be looking at a much wider understanding of what is a prosperous, good society.
Aaron, just very quickly,
this trickle-down theory on the economy. What seems to have happened is gravity has failed because it's not working and people are not paying taxes in this country. They're paying them outside of they're putting their money into tax havens. If we had that money here, then we could afford the public services.
Well, and also, of course, most of the big companies are doing exactly the same. In fact, I have to say, most of the big media companies, they keep much of their money. People like the Daily Mail and Sky, they keep it out of the country. And the Guardian. As we hear. Anyway, Aaron, £30 million, we're taking with one hand and giving with the other.
Yeah, it's all out of the same pot, and let's not forget this. We haven't got a new, fresh pot. It's not a new, fresh £30 million come from nowhere. It is all out of the same hole, and yeah, I can see why people in Bristol are annoyed, and I would be if I was a Bristol resident person.
Stephen, what do you make of this? People looking at this saying, actually, the figures just make it look as if you've shifted a bit from one budget to another, away from the City Council.
Well, I can see why people might say that, particularly for cynical journalist Tony, puts a thought into their minds. They might not have thought of it otherwise. But to be honest, these are completely different responsibilities and completely different budgets. All of what the regional mayor and the combined authority is going to be doing is currently done by ministers in London, mainly by the Department of Communities and Local Government, where I was a minister, and the Department of Transport and the Department of Business and Energy. Those powers are now coming here, and they're coming with quite a lot of money. Hundreds of millions of pounds is coming to this area so that we can decide how we spend it, or the regional mayor and the three leaders of the councils on some occasions can decide how that money is going to be spent. That, I think, is a major step forward to how we've run this country before. So, rather than be cynical about it, I think we should welcome it, get out and vote, and elect the best person.
Darren, are you pleased to see this week's announcement that Colston Hall will be changing its name? And if so, what should it be changing its name to?
Well, this is it's an important conversation, and I think where I stand on this is, there's two sides to it. One is that we have to acknowledge what went on. we have to keep that current. It's a clear and present issue in Bristol that is across. In fact, I've just come from Cabot Tower, another issue, if you like, and these are dotted around all over Bristol. So it's right and proper that we're having the conversation, but I do wonder whether changing the name of something is the best way to deal with the overall conversation. But having said that, at the end of the day, I think it's right and proper that the organisation are looking at it. I think it's good that people are getting involved in the conversation, but I don't think it's part of the. It's for Metro Mayor candidates to wade in and on one side of the argument or the other.
Okay, Aaron Foote, Edward Colston was a slave trader, made much of his money through trading in slaves. It's been decided in Bristol that it's not appropriate to have our main concert hall named after him.
But there's other places, and we've got to look at this. And should we be changing history? I don't think we can. We should be educating and looking forward and saying, well, we've already said sorry for our mistakes in the past, and let's move on. And personally, a name doesn't always work. We've got to look at other companies that have been rebranded in the past. Look at BT, they changed to Openreach and that failed. People still remember the previous history. We've got to remember the fact that changing a name doesn't eradicate history.
I mean, just one thing I can remember from a few years ago when they were first building Cabot Circus, they were going to call it Merchant's Quarter. Yes. And there was an absolute hoo-ha with various people, yes. including the guy who was the chair of HTV, he was a merchant venturer as well at the time, really nice chap, saying, no, this is not appropriate. Anyway, Stephen, what do you make of this name change?
I applaud Louise Mitchell and the Bristol Music Trust for doing this, because they knew it was going to be hugely controversial whenever they did it. And I'm glad they've given effectively 3 years' notice before it happens, because the Colston Hall will shortly close for a major refurbishment, and I think is going to reopen in about 2020 as a fantastic new auditorium for the city. And that would be the right point to give it a new name, because it will be a transformed venue. I agree with Darren, though. The way you deal with painful history, and that's what Bristol's involvement in the slave trade is, ought to be painful for all of us, even those of us who are only current generation Bristolians, is to acknowledge it, interpret it, discuss it, and understand it. But there's no reason for people who currently live in the city to feel guilty about it, because slavery was something that was perpetuated by rich white men 250 years ago. So there's no reason for current Bristolians to be made to feel guilty about it. And a lot of oppression, a lot of terrible behaviour towards Irish people, for instance, was done, sending them to the plantations at the time. Lots of people were executed for stealing apples. The past is a horrible place, frankly, when you go that far back. And there's a lot of things that we don't acknowledge properly. And when I was a young councillor in the 1990s, it was me, and before Leslie Explodes, there was a Labour councillor called Pat McLaren, and we were the two people who persuaded Bristol City Council at that point to put a display in the Georgian House on just off Park Street, on Great George Street, because there was nothing there to acknowledge the fact that the Pinney family, who owned the Georgian House, got their fantastic wealth from sugar plantations in Nevis. And that little display, which is in the attic on the top floor, hasn't changed, I think, since 1996. And Pat and I were the people who were on the Leisure Services Committee at the time who thought it was a good step forward. And then to get a major display into what was the new Empire and Commonwealth Museum. So I've been involved with this for a long time. And I think, personally, that this may be controversial, probably some people won't like this, the Edward Colston statue, now that we're about to finish the Metro bus works, should be moved. I think it should be put inside the museum, inside either the art gallery or M Shed, with a proper display around it about the role of prominent Bristolians in this dark period of our past.
Not in the basement, then.
No, because that would cover it up. And people need to understand it.
Okay, and also, I mean, you know, one would have thought that there might be some statues to the people who helped end the slave trade, campaigners here in Bristol, for example. Anyway,
Clarkson, yeah.
Leslie, what do you make of this? Is it something that you think is important, Colston Hall having its name changed, and if so, to what?
Well, I welcome the actions of the Trust, and I think the issue really is that we make sure that we don't perpetuate discrimination, and I don't see anywhere where we've made a major move where we haven't done that, and that's a bit of a worry. So if you look at the Cabot ship, the Matthew, it was faithfully rebuilt a few years ago with £1 million worth of money, and I believe John Savage was involved in that. And while black people in St Paul's are saying, but we want jobs, they were told, oh no, we can only spend this money on a ship. So instead of doing something more positive with that money, and I don't disagree, it was a nice ship, but the history of that ship and what it did in the triangular trade was absolutely outrageous. There was no apology given to black people, and no reparations were given to black people, although it was all given to the landowners. The plantation owners got money as a result. So I think one thing we could have done, and one thing did happen after the building of the Matthew, was that there was an exhibition in the museum on the slave trade, but that is no longer there. Liverpool has got a permanent exhibition, so why not here in Bristol?
Well, it's worth mentioning, isn't it, that the Empire and Commonwealth Museum, after they did their amazing, it actually was quite an impressive exhibition on the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery, was promptly closed down. Anyway,
if you want another name, for a start, there's lots of black people in this community who the Colston Hall could be named after. People like Sarah Hack at Deck Bar, people like Rosa Hoy in the Chinese community. Why haven't we got a Chinese?
Okay. Anyone else like to put a final bid in for
what about Jimi Hendrix? He played at the Colston Hall.
Darren, anyone else? Stephen or Aaron, anyone else like to have a final bid for the new name for the hall?
It's a bit of a minefield, this. I think the Colston Hall is actually named after... It's not named after Edward Colston. Of course, it's named after the fact because it's on Colston Street. If only when they built it in the 1860s, they'd used the back door and called it Trenchard Street. I think the Trenchard Hall sounds quite nice.
OK.
But no doubt, Trenchard did something dreadful I don't know about.
OK. Staying with the merchants, this is a bigger question, really. Do the city's merchant venturers have a role in making Bristol a better city to live in? We'll start with you this time, Leslie.
Well, I'm not sure of their role entirely. They're sort of a bit of a secret society, aren't they? Clearly they do have a role in the way that big business does. But what we don't do is ensure that all businesses are involved, or whatever type they are, whether they're community interest companies or voluntary organisations. And this is one of the things with the Metro Mayor, and what I want to see is how we bring all these different organisations together so we can look at how we get the best for everyone rather than getting just something for a few.
Aaron, we've got this organisation, the Merchant Venturers. They've been around for hundreds of years. Yep. Actually, as we were pointed out, as was pointed out on this programme a few months ago by one of the professors up at the university, actually, they were the same families that financed John Cabot in his original trip to the United to discover America, even though the Native Americans had already discovered it hundreds and thousands of years before. What do you make of this society? Which actually, one of the interesting things about the venturers is that they won't publish their accounts because they're a charter, incorporated under a royal charter. I'll try and get it right. They don't actually ever have to publish their accounts, so we don't actually know even how much money they've got.
And they funded all sorts of activities and stuff in and around Bristol. They funded schools and stuff like that around here. And to be honest, I actually went to one of the schools that they did fund locally. And we can't deny the fact that they have funded fantastic thing since, and I think what we've got to look at is how we can play the role further and open up more transparency and accountability in that. They fund massive projects throughout Bristol and the surrounding area. Let's actually see what they do and open it up for transparency and accountability.
Yes, it's a shame that John Savage couldn't be with us, as he's a former master of the Merchant Ventures, and he would probably have been able to tell us if he'd felt he wanted to
better
how much wealth they actually had. Anyway, Stephen, what do you make of this question about the role of the Merchant Ventures in Bristol?
Let's keep this brief. I think we're going slightly off topic now. I've always struggled with them, and I used to describe them to people as sort of uber Freemasons, really, a cut above Freemasons even, because they were very small, secretive society. I think there's only about 25 of them at any point in time. Until relatively recently, it was entirely male. I suspect at the moment it's still entirely white. They do control hundreds of millions of pounds in terms of assets, physical assets and cash in the city. They do some good charitable work, undoubtedly. They have, and this is something I would welcome, recently they realised that they've got a problem because, you know, they had heaps of criticism in the 90s and noughties from lots of investigative journalists, including yourself, Tony. I remember Venny used to turn them over, a magazine I miss a lot in Bristol on a regular basis. So they have done things such as sponsor the Merchants Academy in Hartcliffe in South Bristol and have started to get involved in the trickier aspects of education rather than what they've traditionally done, of course, which is they are the body that sits behind many of the city's private schools. Sounds as though I may be in a minority here, and certainly amongst Aaron and Darren as a comprehensive school oik.
So. Okay, one of the things I would point out, you mentioned Freemasonry, I love it when people bring it up and they're not me, is that the merchants have exactly the same system as the Masonic lodges do, where you start with the master is the master of the merchant venturers. You've also got the senior warden, who will be the master next year, and the junior warden, who will be the master the year after that. And those wardens are supposed to be, anyway, in charge of enforcement. In other words, they'll come and knock on your door, what are you up to, kind of thing, and they will get promoted to be the master in 1 or 2 years' time. But anyway, Darren, what do you make of this question? Do the merchants have a role making Bristol a better city to live in?
I certainly think there is a role for philanthropy. There is a role for charitable giving. It's just a shame that those processes seem to be picking up the gap left by funding, the lack of funding from government, and we seem to be going in that direction. For me, what would be more... Well, the more worrying bit is the soft power, that quiet influence that's going on in the background. So I'm more worried about the use of and the misuse of power than I am about the money. Having said that, you know, Bristol is one of the most unequal cities in the country. We've got rich and poor, cheap by jowl, with things like 10-year differences in mortality and 20-year differences in good, healthy lives. And I don't feel as if some of those projects have that are, you know, rebuilding and to schools, yes, great, but have really gone to the heart of tackling that wider society inequality. So... I think there are bigger issues that should be done more publicly to more fundamentally tackle the inequality.
Leslie?
I just wanted to add to what I was saying earlier on about getting all the different organisations together, because Darren was just talking about the funding gap. A number of voluntary organisations are finding that their funding is being cut because of the cuts to the local authority, from the local authority. So projects like the Brigstow Project, which supports people with HIV... projects like Terence Higgins Trust and also Freedom Youth itself, which I was chair of for 5 years. You know, the worry is, and it's not just those projects, the worry is that those projects are going to disappear, and yet they provide a valuable service at a lower rate that can be probably provided everywhere else. But when you try and raise funds for those organisations, I've been trying to do that, I know how difficult it is, but when you start talking about philanthropy, they're not the flavour of the month organisations that's going to pick up that money. They're not seen as being, I suppose, deserving enough projects, and especially not when it's HIV. It's a bit better now than it used to be, but lots of things, the discrimination, the homophobia and all the rest of it, has not gone away.
Let's move on to talk about some of the direct responsibilities you'll have, starting, I think, with you, Stephen, this time. This is housing. You've got a big job because last time I looked, there were nearly 20,000 people registered homeless just in the Bristol area. And, of course, we're talking about a much wider area than that. You need to build something like 15,000 homes straight away.
Yeah, it is a big challenge. The people on the housing waiting list, which is the figure you gave, is not the same as being homeless, of course, and that's a much smaller number, wants to move into accommodation that is appropriate for their needs. And we don't have that balance of accommodation available either in Bristol or in the two other local authorities either. For people who want to buy their first home, it is now incredibly difficult to do so, because in Bristol you have to borrow 10 times your salary if you're a young person just starting work. Obviously impossible for people to do. In Bath it's even worse, it's 12 times. So the answer to that is to build more homes of all different types. Homes for sale, homes for the private rental sector, which are properly managed, rather than the rather haphazard way that the private rental sector has usually worked in this country and hasn't worked in the interests of tenants, but also more social housing as well. And the idea I've come up with in my manifesto to address this, because you'll need more state intervention to make it work. If you leave it to the market, we'll be waiting a very long time, frankly, is to set up the largest social enterprise in in the West Country, which will look at building homes for sale, for private rental, and will then reinvest the surplus from that into building flats and houses for social rent. And that's how a classic social enterprise should work, and I want to set that up in Bristol and work with housing associations to get the best practice.
Okay, Aaron, this is a hell of a challenge. 15,000 houses, we need them right now.
Yeah, we do, and we can't deny the fact we've got to look at brownfield sites. We've got to build upwards, not outwards, and we have to start building the right houses. We keep building all these townhouses on greenfield sites that are just there for the developers. We've got to move forwards here. We've got to make sure that developers stop land banking, because the only reason they really land bank is to create an artificial market. They're holding back property development so they can increase.
Hang on,
the
man.
Place.
They're not developers. They're speculators.
Well, they are. Yes.
They think they're developers, but they're not.
Yes, we've got thousands of properties that have been passed through planning over the last year, and they've just been held up, and they're being held up on purpose so they can speculate on prices. And we've got to get that moving. We have powers to get that moving. We can just negotiate for one, and yeah, we have the power to purchase act if we have to.
Leslie, big task this, isn't it?
Absolutely it is, and this has been going on for so long now. We've got to a position where here we are in the west of England looking to create 80,000 jobs, and people can't afford to live anywhere. It's not just about buying a property, it's about renting a property too. What we need to do is build council houses, and we keep hearing this, that everybody's going to build council houses, well, or houses, and in actual fact what we're building is houses that people are buying as their investment, for their pension. So the Harbourside was bought up largely by Malaysians who saw it as a good investment. What's happening is that people are being priced out of the market in terms of renting. And both the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats are saying, well, we need to build more houses, but they've opposed them right across the west of England, and we need to build more. In less than a year, Marvin Rees has already got 1,700 council houses that he's building, and we need more of those. What I want to see as Metro Mayor is we work with organisations like Acorn to make sure we have that fair tenants charter in place. And I'd also want to work with government, and after the 8th of June there'll be a Labour government that we can work with, that we can pressurise, that will listen and do something different about capping rents, about ensuring that people can afford somewhere to live.
Stephen, you wanted to come in here?
Just because I misheard what Leslie, did you say Marvin Rees has built 1,700 new council houses?
He's got 1,700 planned building in less than a year of being in office.
He's planning to build 1,700?
Yeah, well, he
hasn't built, because the ones that are built, of course, were all planned by the previous administration. In fact, going all the way back to when the Lib Dems ran the council.
Can we have a little discussion here, maybe very briefly, about how long it actually takes to get through the process of doing this, Darren?
Well,
a year seems like a very short time to actually, you know, kind of plan, develop and build and then sell or else rent out houses.
Absolutely. So I'm on the board of the Bristol Community Land Trust, and so I've got a reasonable handle on how long it takes to get hold of land, get planning permission, get it designed and get the houses actually built. The reality is that any houses that are being built at the moment are the result of the previous 4 years' work. There's no doubt. The thing that isn't magically going to change as soon as we get into office is the planning system. The planning system needs to be assisted by a presumption in favour of development that has a higher level of affordable units and a higher set of design standards for sustainability. So that's one thing we can do.
But, Cheryl, because a lot of the people who are building houses are saying, well, we're not going to build them unless we can make money at this.
Exactly.
And they're going to be too expensive. In fact, we've got the whole Finsel's Reach thing, where there's some beautiful houses have been built, but that even the place isn't being finished off because the existing places haven't sold.
Yeah, well, the myth is that the problem isn't really about the building of the houses. That's the cheap bit. At the moment, it's the land that's the problem. And the only way we're actually going to make these houses affordable is if the public sector is able to put this land into the market basically for free, and then become a partner in the ownership of those houses going forward. That way we will be able to speed up the supply of social housing, council housing, shared ownership, community land trusts, etc. We've also got to stop right to buy. There is no point the state sector and housing associations. Thankfully, community land trusts were made exempt from the right to buy. But that's another one we've got.
Leslie,
to
do you want to come in quickly there?
It's got to be mixed, hasn't it, housing? You can't just have one thing. If it's going to work, it's got to be a mixed situation. I'd like to see cooperative housing, say, for students. It would be different. But one of the big issues we've got here is that planning applications that are agreed and then the land is not developed. And in Bristol, there's 7,000 of those. And in Baines, there's 4,000. So land sitting there just waiting for it to go up rather than actually build where we actually need properties now.
Okay. Also, well worth mentioning that we've just had this week come into effect something we've been talking about on this programme for a year or so, which is this homelessness prevention bill. This is one of those things you look at and it's a no-brainer. It was some research that was conducted by Crisis, and they used as evidence the different legal status of homeless people in Wales. It would cost, they say, nationally £44 million to impose a homelessness duty on council, so they would then immediately help anyone who was literally didn't have a roof over their head, and that would actually save £47 million, which is the figure which is spent apparently on people who are homeless and who then come to demand other kinds of services. So that's come in this week, which is some good news at least. So planning, housing is one of the biggies, but there's also other wider planning responsibilities you'll have, whoever wins this Metro Mayor contest, and also tidal energy. So let's start with you this time, Aaron. We've got wider planning responsibilities, yep, and also the possibility of tidal energy in the Severn.
Yeah, I think the Severn has been overlooked for many years now. I remember talking to family and relatives saying it's going back 20, 30 years of the tidal barrage, and we've now moved on technology. We can not have a barrage and we can actually have tidal energy. Let's look at that. And whilst we're looking at things like that, maybe when it's making a profit, we invest that back into social housing for our homeless. We shouldn't be having homeless people on our streets. It is an absolute disgrace in 21st century democracy that we have people living rough. Let's actually build our social housing. We haven't had enough social housing built now for the last like 10, 15 years. Let's actually have a revolution on social housing here.
Stephen, what about your wider responsibilities for planning and specifically on things like tidal energy? That is a quite a big responsibility. The planning system, a lot of people sort of shy away from it because it's complicated and boring, but it's really about our futures.
Yes, it's a major opportunity both to join up the planning, the strategic planning, because local planning applications remain with the local authorities, and it's important to say that. But the strategic planning, land use for jobs and housing, can be joined up with a transport plan. I'm sure we're about to come on to transport to get the economy growing in a sustainable way. And one of the areas where I really do want the West of England to be known for in terms of its sustainable economy is sort of green and sustainable energy. We've got this massive opportunity literally on our doorstep with the Severn estuary, and I've put in my manifesto a specific pledge that I will work with the Welsh Government, because obviously the estuary has two sides, to harness the power of the Severn so that we can get clean and renewable energy off into the future for our region.
I think, seem to remember, it was in the mid-late 1800s there was first a design for yes, a Severn barrage.
Rather like the Channel Tunnel, these things take a long time.
It does take an incredible amount of long time here. Anyway, Leslie, what do you make of these wider responsibilities and particularly about the idea of having tidal energy? Because at the moment we've got if anyone wants to look at it, there's the biggest tidal energy system in the world right now being installed up at the northeast coast of Scotland, the MayGen scheme, that's MEYGEN, mm-hmm. And you can find some fascinating figures. That has all been brought ahead by the Crown Estates, because they own the seabed and they've decided that we want to make a bit of money here, and so they're leasing out their seabed to the MayGen people to generate power. Is that sort of thing going to happen here, and what about your wider planning responsibilities?
Well, with regard to the MayGen project, I have read up about that because I'm quite very much in favour of sea turbines. Because in this country, we're an island, you could put sea turbines all the way around the coast. We have two tides a day, and providing somebody doesn't shoot the moon out, then that will continue. And we can generate not just enough electricity, but enough for our own needs and have a surplus. We don't need a really, really expensive project building a barrage that could then damage the wildlife and the estuary as it exists at the moment. But the sea turbines, it's not new technology. They've had them in France for 50 years. And eventually what we could do then, we can just run in lines onshore that would save us having, you know, ugly things on the shore, ugly buildings. We don't need those. We don't need that kind of thing. When we could have, you know, energy almost for free and make a good use of it. Yeah, I don't see why we should have to go to the most expensive option. And in fact, sea turbines are in my manifesto as well. I think that's what
they said that about nuclear, though, didn't they? That it was going to be free.
Let's not go there. But just well, to I mean, clarify what Leslie just said, Stephen here speaking, that I don't think anyone is seriously proposing a barrage right across the Severn. I mean, the Labour government under Gordon Brown looked at that, and I and a group of Liberal Democrats from either side of the Severn estuary set up a special commission. We took loads of evidence in Bristol and Cardiff and concluded against that and said that the way forward was to have what's called tidal lagoons, which I think is what Leslie is referring to. So you have sort of onshore, hugging the coast sort of sea turbines, so you don't affect the ecology of the Severn
itself.
Can you
just clear that up, Leslie?
It's just a more expensive way of doing things when, as I say, we could have sea turbines right around the country and have enough power.
Darren, what do you make of this, the idea that we may be using our... We've got one of the biggest tidal reaches in the world in the Severn. It goes up and down more than any other part of the world, apart from Nova Scotia. Now, they've got turbines under the sea there generating power. Why haven't we?
Well, the reality is that it would need a massive investment. And so people...
But more or less than Hinkley?
Well, I was. Thank you for raising that. What I was going to say was that, you know, the Southwest is blessed by a great range of renewable energy sources, and actually, I think a mix of them is appropriate because it's great to get small investment for solar, allowing people to generate their own electricity, and it's great to have major projects as well. And I think that makes it really important. I have to say, I'm absolutely delighted that mainstream politics now seems to, most of mainstream politics seems to have completely embraced this idea of renewable energy, and it's now across the most of the parties. Of course, it's our current government who has singularly failed to accept the fact that renewable energy is the best way forward for energy production. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And even in, you know, some of the stuff that's going on in America now with the energy technology on smaller scale for greater and greater gain. The other really interesting bit about this is for Bristol and Bath to become a global leader in some of these technologies, and I agree with a lot of what's said, because if we get on with it, we get a bit of practice, we get some engineering expertise, we learn how to do it, and we can then do more of it across the world.
So will we have to go to the Queen, cap in hand, and say, well, please, can we use your seabed?
I hope not.
I think the coalition dealt with that. I remember legislation going through about that when we did the Green Investment Bank. The Crown Estate technically owns the seabed, but I think that's been dealt with.
But the really interesting moment that is about to come upon us is one, the opportunity to say to government, this is what we want to do locally, and we are going to get on and do it. That's one thing. Secondly, is for the government to realise that they have lost the plot on lobbying from fossil fuel companies because the world has moved on. So all I can say is bring it on, and thank you, colleagues, for embracing it all.
Okay. Also,
a bit cheeky, Darren. The Liberal Party and the Liberal Democrats were there a long time before the Ecology Party and the Green Party was formed, saying this was the way forward. So sometimes we have to acknowledge when we agree on something, and not pretend we've joined you a bit late to the party. We've been advocating this for a long time and did a lot in the coalition, which the Tories, and we can agree on this completely, which the Tories now they're in power on their own, are unravelling.
Okay,
because they're afraid of UKIP.
Talking about planning, we've got this thing called the Arena. Is that going to happen? We've got, at the moment, we've got a bridge to nowhere, haven't we, been built over on the far side of Bristol Temple Meads Station. And I wonder if you think that's going to go ahead. Is it something you'd approve of? And would you approve of the idea of spending public money on it? Maybe you first, Aaron.
I think we've got to seriously look at this this sort of scheme, really. We have got to a bridge to nowhere, and we've already ploughed millions of pounds into this scheme, and it's gone nowhere so far. It's similar to the Metro bus, to be honest. We've ploughed 200 million into that, and we haven't currently seen a single bus run on it, and it's delayed by months and months and months. It seems to be that the public sector sometimes doesn't get things quite right, and the private sector sometimes does. Maybe we should look at more private investment and sort it out that way. It's got to be about dialogue. We've got to be open and honest, and we've got to have a transparent system here. We've got to say why we have not so far done it, and we've got to put that out to the people.
Darren, Bridge to Nowhere, we've got that built, but no arena. Do you think we should be building that? Is that something you would be signing off?
Actually, originally, I was not convinced by a massive new arena on this site, especially when there was the opportunity to develop Ashton Gate as a more flexible solution. So I was kind of a bit confused about why we were trying to do that. I do think there is a role for a flexible venue which could be used for a community, more as a community space rather than a big business outside operator. I mean, of course, we all might like to be able to have big names coming in, but actually Bristol's so much more about its grassroots communities, that amazing culture that comes up. So actually I would have preferred a venue that was specifically built to enhance, generate and grow homegrown talent.
Leslie, what do you make of this arena? Is it something that you think public money should be spent on?
You know, it's interesting, as Darren's just said, we have some fantastic talent, musically and otherwise, across the whole of the west of England. And where do you go? I was talking to Johnny Bruce, who's a trumpeter, the other week. He plays in a band called the Moscow Drug Club. And he was saying it's just so hard nowadays to earn. He does lots and lots of work, but he's still finding it a bit of a struggle. And you can only go so far, and then you can't go much further because there's not the venues there. We've got lots of small music venues. We haven't got larger ones. Some 100 years or so ago, in Amsterdam, they didn't have a concert venue there. And the burghers of the city felt that they were being laughed at by the rest of Europe. So they built what's now called the Concertgebouw, which was right on the edge of the city on a piece of swampland. Of course, now it's been absorbed by Amsterdam. It's one of the most fantastic music venues in the world. If you haven't been, do go, because it's got fantastic acoustics there. Jefferson Airplane played there, but they're more noted for the orchestra, also called the Concertgebouw, which owns it as a cooperative. So
is that yes
you
or
know,
no?
Why,
yes or no,
why not? I think this is one thing the Metro Mayor can get involved in and help bring the money down to develop something like this.
Okay.
I think it's something we miss out on.
I think there's a danger, Tony, here of mission creep. A big remit is being devolved to this new position, and there are big powers, and whoever's elected to them is frankly going to have their hands full on discharging those massive responsibilities. We can't have mission creep into all sorts of things that quite rightly lie with local government. I think Marvin Rees was listening to this. He'd be hopping mad at his Labour candidate colleague saying it's something that the Metro Mayor should get involved with. But just to express an opinion, as a Bristol resident, of course we should have an arena and conference venue. It's more than just you know, where we'd go and see big acts. It's about getting trade conventions to the city. Party conferences even could come to the city. And
okay,
a lot of public money has been spent,
yeah,
to answer your question.
You're behind
the
it.
Land was remediated by the South West Regional Development Agency, and the bridge was a grant from the coalition government.
We've got about two minutes to look at Metrobus now. I want each of you to give us your appraisal in 30 seconds each, starting with you, Darren. Metrobus, is it actually going to make any difference?
It will if it's part of an integrated transport system.
Will it be?
It has to be. That's one of the biggest challenges that we've got. Yes, absolutely needs to be part of it, because otherwise it's a complete white elephant and it will get in the way. So we have to make it work as part of an integrated transport solution.
Leslie, Metrobus, oh gosh, I mean, they've been talking about this for a long, long time. Will it make any difference? Should we have something else in trams, something like that?
Well, again, with transport, there's got to be a mixed approach, hasn't there? We've got to look at all sorts of different ways of getting people to people and people to work. It's about getting people onto public transport, onto buses. It's about getting them out of cars and onto cycles and walking. We need to, when we build new developments, ensure that we build safe cycling spaces and walking spaces as part of that. One thing I would like to see, we need to make sure, is that public transport is affordable, as well as it being economical and as well as it being greener. What I'd like to see is free bus passes for young people. It's quite interesting to hear the skills debate we had this morning with the colleges, talking about how young people can't afford to get to college, or they're having to go so far they can't get there. All of them.
I'm going to have to cut you out there, because otherwise the others won't have a chance. Sorry. Metro bus, Aaron.
It's got to work. We spent over £200 million on it so far. We've got to have it, as Darren was saying, it's got to be an integrated system. We've got to have cars integrated into the system, as well as cycling, walking. It has to be integrated. If it's a standalone system, it isn't going to work. We have to integrate.
Stephen, finally, is it just a cheapo tram, and is it going to work?
It's a very expensive alternative to the tram, actually. I mean, a tram on the route that the Metro bus is going would have been so much better, but that was an opportunity screwed up several times in the past, and we are where we are.
OK, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. We'll be back with our Metro Mayor candidates, minus Tim Bowles and John Savage, who are too busy to come, after the Murdoch News at 6, where we'll carry on talking transport.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.